This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Wade in the water, come on and wade in the water, children, wade in the water. My Lord, my God's gonna trouble the water.
Water. Water problems affect half of humanity. Problems of poverty are inextricably linked with those of water, its availability, its proximity, its quantity, and its quality. Over a billion people, around one-sixth of the world's population, have inadequate access to water, and every 20 seconds, a child dies from a water-related disease. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with two experts who are trying to tackle the water problem. First, we speak with Carlos Perea, the CEO of Myox, a company out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, that's developed a cost-effective way to disinfect water.
You know, we can buy bottled water, which has an expense and an environmental impact, or we can start to get more thoughtful about how our water is treated.
Then we speak with Dr. Chandrasekhar Spike Narayan, who leads the Science and Technology Organization at IBM's Almaden Research Center. Spike's team is working on a host of cutting-edge desalination technologies. But first, let's hear from Carlos Perea, the CEO of Myox. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Carlos Perea, the president and CEO of Myox, a water purification company out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Carlos is a mechanical engineer by trade, also has his MBA from Stanford University Graduate School of Business. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Carlos.
Alex, thanks for having me.
Tell us first what Myox does.
Myox purifies water, or we make it safe to use, predominantly for drinking, and we replace the chemicals that are typically used. And we do it more cost-effectively, more safely, and with higher quality than traditional treatment methodologies. We do also have the benefit of removing the need to store and transport hazardous chemicals. So there's a very nice environmental impact as well.
Your technology is essentially...
What we do is we take salt or sodium chloride, we strip away electrons through a process called electrolysis, and we create chlorine in solution with other oxidants. That chemical is a very powerful disinfectant, and it meets all the EPA's requirements for potable water. So again, we're in public drinking water systems.
And did Myox invent this procedure?
Yes. We invented the process that we use, which has a lot of advantages, both from a cost effectiveness as well as a scalability. So our systems are unique in a very easy to understand way. You have communities, Santa Fe, New Mexico, communities around Phoenix, San Antonio, Boulder, Colorado, many others that have used our systems to make water potable for EPA drinking water standards. At the same time, you can buy our system, a small handheld device that the U.S. soldiers use for a personal use. So if you're a hiker, a backpacker, a Peace Corps volunteer, a world traveler, and you're concerned about water quality, having one of our systems makes a lot of sense because it can take stream water or any other source of water and make it safe to use very simply, very quickly, very cost effectively.
In terms of the scale of your projects generally?
Generally, we are treating municipal-sized water treatment facilities. We're in everything from aircraft carriers in the Navy to drinking water systems around the country. I think we have about 1,000 communities or so around the U.S. that are using our systems to do final disinfection of water before it's sent out to the consumers. We're also in industrial applications. You can find us in some of the top-end resorts. And it's a variety of applications, including drinking water, water reuse, swimming pools, aquatics. Any place that you would use chlorine or other biocides to purify water, you could use our system instead.
And when you speak of your systems, what kind of range are we looking at in terms of, was there one initial invention that got the company started, or are there a whole suite of products that you can offer?
The original technology development was for the U.S. military, and the military, when they deploy, water is one of the critical logistics issues. Historically, they've done what we do in the U.S. and lots of places in the world, is they use chlorine. They found that chlorine presents a significant safety hazard. If you have a leak or an accident from a chlorine system, it's very toxic. So the last thing you want to have in your military facility is a toxic chemical that could be released accidentally or on purpose or under fire. So to replace chlorine, they sent out research contracts. Myox, the parent of Myox, I guess, developed a technology to take ordinary salt and to create a safe but powerful disinfection solution that can replace chlorine. That was more than a decade ago, and we're still used extensively in the military. We're on aircraft carriers and other naval ships. We're also on a small handheld basis used by troops out in the field. So our systems range from very small personalized systems to very large scale systems that can treat hundreds of millions of gallons of water a day.
Of course, many of our listeners are familiar with the Kellogg Brown and Root issue that happened in the Iraq war, and soldiers, I believe, were getting sick from impure bathing water. Where along the supply chain do you, as an expert, see that the mistake was made?
Yeah, I think this was probably a relatively poor or antiquated technology coupled with a lack of attention to detail or execution. But the simple way to think about this is, we've treated our water in the U.S. and most of the developed world only in the last 100 years. And prior to treating water, we got sick as a society from water very frequently. Typhoid and other waterborne pathogens actually not only cause people to get sick, it could cause people to die. And there's a lot of evidence that chlorine in our water systems or water treatment overall was one of the biggest health innovations in the last century.
Do you envision Myox being more in the manufacturing scale water purification, or do you see this being for potable water in the third world, if you had to envision the roadmap for your company?
Oh, it's both, but quite frankly, we get a lot of pride in helping to address potable water in the developed world and in the developing world. And one of the advantages of our approach is we can take first world technology that are used in the most advanced treatment plants here in the U.S., we can simplify and miniaturize it and make it appropriate to use in Haiti or in places in Africa or remote villages in Mexico. And we have a tremendous market opportunity, and we sell to cruise ships and to high-end resorts and to municipal water treatment systems and to governments around the world. But at the same time, we're really doing something that has a humanitarian and a health benefit. So I personally get very excited when we have the opportunity to go into a rural community in the developing world or to help in a disaster relief. And the best thing that I've ever seen written about Myox, I didn't come up with. It was a website that wrote that Myox was, because of what we do, a company not only to invest in, but one to root for. And I just love that quote because it summarizes what we believe and what I believe, which is you don't have to choose between doing good business activity and environmentally social and responsible things. You don't have to choose between doing humanitarian projects and selling to big multinational companies.
My guest is Carlos Perea, the president and CEO of Myox, a water treatment disinfection company out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. In terms of the low-end battery-powered version of your product, if an NGO wanted to donate some of your products to a country or a place in need, what kind of per unit cost does that usually entail?
Typically, the retail on a system like that is about $140. It's a military grade product that can be reused and used in treats about a gallon at a time, but you can continue to reuse it just by adding salt and batteries every several hundred liters. We've had a lot of those systems donated, and we've donated some to a variety of applications. We did this post-Katrina. We did this post-the earthquake in Haiti. We did this in combination with a Coca-Cola bottler in Mexico when they had flooding. And in all of these cases, we've had a really good success rate. When we get into the nonprofit or emergency or disaster relief situations, typically, they're less than $100 in volume, and they can treat a tremendous amount of water. Depending on the application, we like to get people into bigger systems that can be run off of car batteries or solar so that we don't have to deal with the lithium batteries that do get exhausted.
How long could a $140
Myox system last is this a village size thing or maybe for a family?
This is more of a family size system. Again, it was designed for the soldier in individual use, but it treats a gallon a time. Every couple of minutes, you could run the system.
And how long do you think that would last? A year? Or?
We've never had one that's failed after 20,000 cycles because, again, they're designed for the military. So you have to replace the batteries about every 50 to 100 cycles, so 50 to 100 gallons.
So the batteries are the biggest developing nations, yeah.
So these are great for either individual or family use or disaster relief. For a sustainable solution for a village, for a small community, we like to get people into slightly larger systems that can treat typically 10 to 50,000 gallons of water per day, which sounds like a lot, but you know, as soon as you have 200, 300, 400 folks, these are the small kinds of systems that we typically have. And those are very, very cost effective and again, can be run off of battery or DC power. And all they need is ordinary food grade quality salt to make them work.
That was Carlos Perea, the CEO of Myox. We'll have more from Carlos in a minute, but let's turn now to our discussion earlier with Spike Narayan of IBM. His team is working on a wide range of desalination technologies. Let's discuss one of the more innovative and vital technologies your team's working on, Spike, in the area of water desalination. Can you tell our listeners a little more about it?
Sure. So this is actually something that came out of our work that we did for our own company in the area of materials for lithography for semiconductor processing. In that program, we developed deep skills in understanding how polymer materials and water interact. And from that came a very interesting project, which was dealing with how do you use polymer films to purify water in different ways. And so this concept of nanomembranes was born out of our work for the semiconductor industry materials. And so what this program has evolved into is a capability to develop reverse osmosis membranes. And of course, these membranes have been around for a while now. The difference between what we do and what we get in the marketplace are manifold. One is, if you look at the typical problems that confront the reverse osmosis industry today, there are three key pieces. One is the fact that these membranes tend to get fouled, or the one way to look at it is after you use these membranes for a short period of time, they tend to get clogged. I'm using the term a little loosely. It's the amount of water that's transported through these membranes in unit time. So that tends to degrade very quickly due to a concept called fouling, which is you can look at it as blocking or clogging of these membranes. That's one problem. Second problem is these membranes tend to get attacked by chlorine, which is there in the water. Chlorine is a necessary part of the drinking water today. And chlorine is very damaging to reverse osmosis membranes today. And the third one is the energy required to create drinking water using reverse osmosis is very large. And the reason why the energy consumption is so high is because you need to pressurize water on one side of the membrane tremendously to get good clean water on the other side. And so all the energy that's going into pumping water to keep the pressures very high is what makes the reverse osmosis process very energy hungry. So these are the three problems that we're attacking. By nanoengineering these membranes, polymer films, we're able to create membranes that don't tend to get fouled, that are very resistant to chlorine attack, and can significantly increase how much water you can transport through these films in unit time. So we are going after three of the biggest challenges that reverse osmosis membranes in the marketplace have today. We're hoping to reduce the cost of ownership of these technologies significantly by impacting all three critical pieces.
And is your product solely for consumer water consumption, or is there would it also be for agricultural use or the oil industry?
So this is an extremely interesting question because the membrane technology that I talked about has many, many facets to it. So one aspect of it is desalination. So taking seawater and creating drinking water is one aspect of it. Second is removing harmful contaminants from water. So for example, arsenic in groundwater is a major problem in many parts of the world. So groundwater is getting contaminated at an alarming rate. And so arsenic was an example I picked because one of the first membranes we developed in this program last year proved to be extremely effective in filtering out arsenic from groundwater. So that's the drinking water aspect of it. You brought up agriculture in your comment, and that's an interesting one because in Central California, even though there is a lot of groundwater to be had, if you drive down Route 5, you'll see these big signs that says Congress created dust bowls, right? Because it's basically all farmland is all dry because there is no water from the Sacramento Delta. And the reason why it's a big issue is the groundwater cannot be used because of boron in the water. And the membranes that we created also have the ability to remove boron from the water, so making all this groundwater usable for agriculture. So there are many facets to treating water, and as we understand more and more about how we are contaminating the groundwater, we need to come up with solutions to effectively remove these contaminants from water so a lot of the water can be reused.
Would the reverse osmosis process be something that would be a unique construction facility, or could this be adapted to current wastewater or water treatment facilities?
So there are two ways to look at it. One is we have municipalities that create streams for drinking water, right? So this would be something that you can go to an existing reverse osmosis plant and simply change the filter module to one that uses these advanced technologies. So then the cost of ownership of these plants would decrease, because you would need to replace them much less often. And these membranes can actually be more effective in removing contaminants than today's membranes. So this would be, in one way, going to municipalities and changing the filter module, so to speak. So that's one plug-and-play way of doing it. The other way is going after industrial waste streams, which actually we don't do much about today. A lot of the waste from industries are treated in a very crude way and discharged. And so we really don't pay attention to the kind of contaminants that are there in the waste streams. So now this technology would give you a way to take some of the waste streams and reuse the water. In fact, this water reuse is a theme that's going to be getting increasingly important as the scarcity issue starts to get magnified. And it is going to happen soon.
It's one of the things that people in the U.S. tend to take for granted. But many, many people in the world are spending a lot of their day worrying about their water. Could you take a step back and tell us a little bit about what some of the more aggressive desalination projects in the world are currently underway and how the IBM innovation would differ?
So we have a program with a government lab in Saudi Arabia looking specifically at desalination in that geography. So we're currently at a point where we're developing some membrane technologies that are suited to desalination in that area. And we're thinking about creating a pilot plant there in the next 3 years to produce fresh water from the sea.
But there are some projects that are already up and running. Could you talk a little bit about how they work in terms of their efficiency in converting salt water to water and how your project would differ?
Yeah, so I think, like you correctly point out, there are many desalination plants in the world. Some of the older plants are what they call thermal desalination, basically evaporating water and condensing the fresh water. But all the newer plants that are cropping up around the world are all reverse osmosis plants. And like I said, there are three fundamental drawbacks with reverse osmosis, like I talked about earlier. And the way our membranes would play in that space is reducing the energy required to get clean water, creating membranes that don't have to be replaced often in the field, and creating membranes that don't get damaged by chlorine. So we are hoping to impact it from a cost of ownership perspective, in addition to creating other capabilities like removing contaminants. So the contaminant issue is very specific to certain geographies. Different parts of the world have different ground contamination just due to the geology. Nothing to do with industrial contamination, which is another aspect of it. And so we can actually engineer membranes to effectively remove or make the water in the local geography clean, depending on how what it is.
What kind of waste stream would be produced by a typical, some of the older desalination plants compared to the newer ones that your team is trying to develop?
So this is actually a very fascinating question, because all of these reverse osmosis or any other desalination project the waste stream is extremely concentrated salt water, and that actually is damaging to the ocean life as well. And so how do you treat or the discharge from a desalination plant is actually an issue, which we are just starting to think about in many different ways. So for example, this is just a wild idea that we've been thinking about. There is a concept called forward osmosis, which actually can be used to produce power when you bring together fresh water and concentrated salt water. And in the bargain, you end up diluting the salt water to a point where now it is safe to discharge back into the ocean. So we have to think about innovative ways in which we deal with waste streams, which is, like you pointed out, a very important problem with reverse osmosis or any other form of desalination today.
I don't know the measurement that you use, but could you tell us what an older plant would, how it would produce 1 gallon of fresh water versus what your aims are?
Okay, so it's difficult to put numbers on it because what we quantify the efficacy of a membrane is how much of the salt it can actually reject. So for example, salt water typically has, when you get it from the ocean, has about 35,000 ppm of salt, parts per million of salt in water. And drinking water should have less than 500 ppm. So unless you get membranes that are at least 99.5% efficient, you cannot get good grade drinking water from seawater.
That's Dr. Chandrasekhar Spike Narayan, who leads the Science and Technology Organization at IBM's Almaden Research Center.
Water on the ground, cloud on the sun, moon on the rise, and a wind on the run. But you know it's only water. Water on the ground.
The highest average water use in the world is by far in the U.S. at 160 gallons per day, and that number doesn't even include the amount of water used to feed and clothe us. To put that in perspective, in the UK, average daily water use is 40 gallons per day, and the average African uses 5 gallons per day. Now back to our discussion with Carlos Perea, the CEO of Myox.
Since you're in the industry, and I should mention that Myox has been around since 1994, manufacturing on-site water disinfectant generators. What have you seen over the last 16 years in terms of regulatory changes?
Yeah, regulatory changes are typically far and few between in the water industry. It's a relatively slow-moving industry. I think the most significant change in the last couple of years or 5 years or so that affect my particular part of the industry are the water quality standards associated with surface water. And the EPA has become more sophisticated about regulating the water that might be in a stream or a lake or a reservoir for certain contaminants relative to water that might be coming from a deep well where it might be more pristine. And so those standards are very recent. The other one, though, that affects us very dramatically are chemical safety handling regulations, which sounds perhaps to somebody who doesn't understand how the process works, it may not be a direct connection. But again, all water has chemical in it for EPA quality standards. And the way that chemical typically gets in the water is it's produced in a big chemical facility, it's put into a gas form or in a liquid form, it's put on a railway or on a truck, it creates a huge safety and liability hazard, and then it goes in our communities where it is probably the single biggest risk to public health in the event of a leak or a discharge of that chemical. And it's just an antiquated system, and it's something that, you know, we want to start thinking about not only how do we replace those systems, but also how do we do it in a more cost-effective way. And so companies like Myox and other innovators, I think, are having some success, especially as chemicals are more highly regulated. But as a case in point, post 9/11, industrial users of these chemicals were much more highly regulated. Municipality drinking water systems were exempt from those regulations. So personally, I would rather live across the street from an Intel facility or another industrial user of chemicals because I know they're held to a much higher standard than to be living down the street from a water treatment facility because it may be very well run, but it may not, and it's not held to those same quality and safety standards. And San Francisco's a great example of a system that, you know, I don't know the quality of the personnel, but I can tell you that the process that they use is to not only use chlorine, but to use ammonia. So now you have two hazardous chemicals that they combine into something called chloramines, and that's what's injected into the water for the San Francisco Water Utility. And there's a lot of reasons why they do that that makes sense for the EPA drinking water quality standards. But just think about having ammonia and chlorine in your community if you happen to live in some proximity to that water treatment facility. Extraordinarily unsafe.
Really? But it's safe to drink?
It can be. But again, chloramines have a whole set of safety issues and health issues that are probably much less studied than some other systems.
What cities do you think have the best reputation in the water industry as having the safest, cleanest drinking water?
I couldn't point to a specific community. I will say that communities that are getting their water from deep wells are much more likely to have higher water quality than communities that are getting their water from surface water. So it's not only these, you know, industrial processes or energy extraction. It's a whole host of reasons that we're figuring out that our water quality systems are not what we'd like. You know, we can buy bottled water, which has an expense and an environmental impact, or we can start to get more thoughtful about how our water is treated. And the problem in the U.S., to some extent, is we were so successful as a society in having high-quality, low-cost water that we forgot that there's a big cost and there's also a quality issue. And so I think there's a swing back in the U.S. and indeed everywhere that water quality is a big deal, and it does cost money to treat water. It does cost money to transport water. I've read studies that conclude that in California, as an example, 20 to 25% of all the energy in California is used to process or transport water. I think the other component, though, is we're starting to see, or at least in my experience, we're seeing more of communities in the U.S. looking globally for good examples for water conservation, water reuse, intelligent water management. And there are places in the world that have had to deal with water in a much more advanced way than we have in the U.S. Australia is a good example, just doesn't have much water. I think the stat is that if you take all of the water runoff in Australia, all of their rivers, it doesn't add up to the Mississippi. It's very arid. And so they've been very thoughtful about taking rainwater when it does rain, capturing that and using it for agricultural and household purposes. Singapore and Israel are two other examples where they've gotten very good at water reuse, water conservation, water desalination. And so I think more and more in the U.S., we're going to have to look to other places in the world for these solutions.
Well, Carlos Perea, President and CEO of MIOX. It's MIOX, by the way.
Thanks so much for being with us on Sea Change.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Additional music by The Blind Boys of Alabama, Eric Clapton, and Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.